We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to a very special edition of the Inside of the Cross Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and for the first time in almost 5 years, I'm joined by Quinn Kesnick, my longtime podcast co-host. Quinn, how you doing?
Good. I'm a little, I didn't sleep well after that Princeton Lehigh game last night, but I'm loving these early week games on ESPN Plus. Like last week, I watched BU Harvard, I watched Dartmouth Virginia. Last night, I got to watch Lehigh Princeton, and I just, to me, it's just such an added benefit.
Spotlight games, regardless of when in the week it is, but certainly to your point, if it's a weeknight, if you are in a standalone time slot, you are going to get a disproportionate amount of attention. And when it comes to analysts like you and me, what that means is that we can lock in on a single game in ways that we can't on Saturdays and Sundays.
It's invaluable for me, honestly. I watched it knowing that I could see Princeton in the Ivy League tournament, but it was a good chance just to sit and relax. One game going on, you're not on your phone chasing scores. And I was impressed with Lehigh, too. I can see why, they're going to be a little bit of a threat in the Patriot League. Casey Heath was unbelievable between the pipes. He had 24 stops. But Princeton, I walked away saying that Princeton's a legitimate national championship caliber team.
Well, that's a good place to start. It is April 1st that we are recording. Happy April Fools. It is Matt Kinnear's least favorite holiday, so we are not going to gauge in any tomfoolery. He absolutely hates it.
I've already got a DM about them adding mandatory equipment for women's lacrosse from a friend in Florida. I'm like, bro, but you got to check your calendar, man. Check your calendar.
But what April 1st does very neatly and cleanly represent is the midpoint of the year. And given that we were originally planning to record this on Tuesday and technology got in the way, we are effectively exactly halfway between beginning and end. And in reality, we're more than halfway because, as we've discussed at too much length, too many Division I men's college teams front load their schedules. That was proved imprudent in the first part of February this year.
And, Terry, I look at the season, I look at it in thirds, and we are somewhere in the middle of third right now. There's the winter portion of the schedule, right? And you see some crazy stuff happening in February and then early March. Weather, certain teams start in certain dates, non-conference matchups, everything's a little wonky. Right now we're in the conference schedule. And these are great games because the weather's getting nice. People go back to campus. You got rivalry games within the leagues and everyone's trying to jockey for position. And then season three is clearly the postseason. So I like this season. I think it's an important season for the health of the sport.
I know you hate doing this, but I do think the best way to structure this conversation is to start by looking back, because I think the best way to frame how you digest the first 2 months and how that sets the foundation for expectations for the next 2 months requires or benefits from revisiting what your preseason thought process was. And because we didn't discuss this on a podcast, what was it? What was your general thesis heading into 2026?
Well, I thought that Maryland, after a strong showing last year in the tournament, returning a lot, plus their two transfers from Yale, I thought Maryland was going to be a steady force in the top five. So to me, that's been the biggest surprise, that the Terps picked up four losses. Because on paper, coming into this year, you really had to like their team. Things didn't work out. They dealt with a lot of injuries during the fall. They've not gelled chemistry-wise. Their young players haven't contributed as much as Coach Tillman might have had. That being said, they're still alive, and they're still a major threat, knowing their history and knowing their staff and the talent on that roster. But to me, Maryland, with four losses, is probably the headliner of surprises.
So that's very specific. Do you have like a more general? Because frame mine. Okay, go ahead.
Well, nine teams, I think, are capable of winning the national championship.
Did you feel that way on January 31st?
I don't know. We felt it was going to be an open year. This was one of the years I felt it was going to be open to who could get to championship weekend. I didn't know about the viable championship teams, but, I pencil it right now. I got nine teams who could win a national championship and I wouldn't blink. And I got about a dozen who could make a run to Charlottesville championship the weekend this year, returning to campus, a dozen who are in the hunt for the Final Four. So that's good. I think that's healthy. And I think that speaks to the excitement that we're going to be seeing in April and May.
So there's the class of 2024 was considered to be the double draft, right? Because it had the kids who withdrew in 2020 and all that other stuff. But what's interesting is when you reflect on the amount of graduated talent in 2025, it probably wasn't as much as 24, but the number of combined holes that needed to be filled across the top 20 roster spots was as great or greater because of, you know, seniors who got an opportunity to play for the first time or whatever else. And, you know, when you looked at the kind of preseason talent returning in 26, only Joey Spallina met the kind of standard that guys like CJ Kurist and Chris Kavanaugh and Jay Taylor did in 2025, much less Connor Schellenberger and Brennan O'Neill and the likes of Pat Kavanaugh, the likes of 2024. So for me, that is the undergirding reason for this wide openness. But I want to frame it as a question for you. The adage is defense wins championships. I don't agree with that. I think defense wins games. I think offense wins championships in men's lacrosse. Do you agree with that?
In the shot clock here, I agree with you. And there's an article, one of my polls, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. You know, I looked at that in regard to Ohio State because, you know, they're scoring 6 goals a game. And I was like, is that sustainable? So I went back and I looked at all the playoff scores from last season. You got to get to 11, 12, 13, 14 goals to win a NCAA men's lacrosse playoff game against a quality opponent in the shot clock era. So there's a certain offensive efficiency threshold that seems to need to be met. And so I would agree with you that if you can't score, eventually you'll be ratted out as a fraud.
And that's important in the way that it manifests, both from the standpoint of stars, right? Those are the guys that you consistently rely on to score 4, 5, 6 points a game in the highest leverage moments when they are being guarded by your opponent's best player and they are the focal point of the game plan. And then you have to rely on your third, fourth, and fifth offensive options in order to produce. You don't need all of them to produce in those pivotal games. You need to consistently be able to rely on 1 to 1.5 in those highest leverage games. And then you need to be able to scram goals out of transition, off the faceoff, in ride back situations. And because no two of those will get you to 11 versus or 13 against quality competition. What have you seen so far in terms of a team or a player where you feel like either their tertiary, their secondary scoring, or their style of play when it comes to transition and unsettled gives you hope or gives you confidence disproportionately in their ability to be successful in May?
Well, and before that, to tail off what you said, I thoroughly agree with it. The one thing is the play of specialists. And I think that surfaced on Sunday when Harvard lost to North Carolina because they couldn't win a faceoff. They had no chance in that game when Brady Wambach wins 22 or 25. So I don't care how efficient your offense is. If you're lacking in the ability to get the ball through faceoffs or through saves, you got problems. So those are complementary to what you said in terms of offense. But when I look at this year, you know, the 8 or 9 teams I think that can win the national championship all have guys who can score. Richmond's got guys who can score from last year, Aiden O'Neill leading the way. Carolina with Dominic Petromala and Owen Duffy and their young midfielders and their ability to score off the faceoff with Brady Wambach, they can score. Syracuse, we've seen them scoring. Duke, you know, had a lot of questions about Duke at 8-0, but I thought in the Dome the other day, they proved with Max Sloat and Ben Johnston that they can score. Notre Dame's offense has not been on fire the last 3 outings. We'll see if they can improve. And then Virginia, all you can say is, you know, they've won 3 in a row, Utah, Dartmouth, and then the nice win over Notre Dame at home last Saturday. With the Millen brothers and with Ryan Colsey and Truett Sunderland's playing at a high level, they're in the game. They're in the game because they can score. And so if they can just tighten up the defense and win some faceoffs, Andrew Greenspan's been a plus, and Jake Marrick between the pipes done great. That's a team that could potentially be dangerous. Penn State, their offense was clicking against Ohio State, and that's without Hunter Aquino. So I'm putting Penn State in the mix. Maryland, they would need some kind of revival offensively. And then finish off with the team we saw last night, Princeton. Princeton's got as good a top 6 as any team in the country. They have got a solid defense, a very good goalie, a good face-off man, and Andrew McMeekin. They got all the parts, man. Princeton, you know, I think Patrick Stevens of U.S. Lacrosse has them at number 1 or number 2 right now in his bracketology. That'll change because the ACC teams are going to get more wins as league season goes on, but Princeton's going to be in a good spot.
All right, let's slow down and go a little deeper on some of those teams. And I want to start with Richmond because, you know, they were certainly one of the stories of 2025, winning their first NCAA tournament game in program history. You know, a decade-old program, founding coach Dan Shamati still in position, and they've grown incrementally, right? And it's a team, you know, I think back to the Mitch Goldberg eras and then what Ryan Lansbury did. And you know, one of the things that I really struggled with, and I talked to Paul Richards a lot about this over last summer, was this iteration of Richmond just felt like it was very difficult for me to get my arms around because they were so democratic in terms of the way that they won. And so when I watched them, you know, their Virginia game last year, their Georgetown game last year, I felt like I came away and I was just like, Hunter Smith is really good, right? I'm confident in that. Jack Pilling is among the top short-safety middies. But beyond that, like Lucas Littlejohn near the top of the list of inside catch-and-shoot finishers, I don't know who is the guy driving winning. And I feel differently about this team because I think Aiden O'Neill has taken a step forward and to me is a deserving top tier to Wharton candidate conversation guy, right? Like, is he going to win it? We all know that that depends on what happens in May, but should he be a finalist if the season were to end today? To me, the answer is indisputably yes. But that is also not the story for Richmond so far this year. Because when I look at what they got out of Zach Vigue and Jared Chinoy last year, it was the culmination of multi-year production. And that was the reason for the bear case for Richmond this season. To get what they've gotten out of a freshman faceoff guy in Vincent Gaylord. And not only, I don't want to oversell him because it's been a little bit more by committee than it was with Chinoy or when it, you know, what some of the other guys like Wambach that you referenced have done for their teams. But then you add in Connor Knight, who you remember two seasons ago played well enough in the preseason in order to unseat Vigue in terms of the starting, the guy who started the year against Maryland. I guess in that frame, it's not that surprising that he's come in and been at almost 58%, but they are actually producing at a higher clip in the specialty positions than they were last year. And we know the cumulative benefit, the compounding benefit that that has at each end of the field. The offense gets more possessions, the defense gets more rest, and the opposing offense gets a little bit more urgent. To me, that's the recipe, and it's a great time to be having this conversation because while they have maintained their very impressive non-conference schedule on a, you know, 10-year basis, they also have this signature game against Notre Dame that, thank goodness, is going to be seen because that was a question for a while. Your thoughts on the Spiders and what Dan Shamati's done with this group?
I don't have any questions about their legitimacy. You go back to that game that I covered at North Carolina last year. They went on the road and beat the Tar Heels in the first round of the playoffs. They gave Cornell their best fight of the season in the quarterfinals. That was a game that Richmond could easily have won. And what would history be saying right now had Richmond won that game and advanced to last year's championship weekend? I agree with you. Question marks at the Fogo and goaltender spot made us a little leery preseason, but those guys have stepped in and delivered. I think this game is big for them. You know, I worry about their conference schedule kind of softening them, but man, do they not give off vibes of Loyola in 2012? I mean, Richmond is like the walking reincarnation of that Greyhound team. Dan Shamati, I believe, was the offensive coordinator for that group.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, just flashback. And I looked at the Greyhound season. I actually called it up this week to take a look at it and see the quality of their wins. And what they went 18-1, I believe. They had that one loss that really kind of galvanized them for the playoffs. And this is just vibes of that mid-major making that first significant run to a national championship. Loyola 2012 and Richmond 2026 are congruent.
That's a great shout out. That game that you're referring to, Loyola's only loss, was their final game of the regular season. At the time, they were still a member of the ECAC. So in conference with Denver was their primary rival that year, and they played a trio of awesome games, including in the NCAA quarterfinals. But they lost the regular season capstone to Hopkins, which was a real gut punch because that was before the one-sidedness of the rivalry had flipped and it felt like an important opportunity to get a win over the Blue Jays. But
it was beneficial. I think it was beneficial for Loyola.
Yeah,
I think it was beneficial for Loyola. And if Richmond loses this game to Notre Dame, to me, it's not going to be the end of the world and I'm not jumping off your bandwagon.
And I think your point is the right one in the sense of conference weight, right? Because in 2012, the Big Ten did not exist, right? So this notion of, I use the analogy of a batting donut, right? You know, the ACC and the Big Ten, because of their conference schedule, and the Ivy League to a less, slightly lesser extent, you know, they get the benefit of having the batting donut that can kind of come off in the first round of the tournament. Whereas, and we've seen this with Georgetown, it's hard, I think, at this point to dispute that the aggregate quality of who they play in April and the first weekend in May has an effect on the need or ability to scale up once you get into the first and second rounds of the NCAA tournament. And that would be the lingering concern, and truthfully will be the lingering concern for Richmond, even though last year they showed that it wasn't the case. But to me, it's justified because there's a lot of similarities between the Big East and the A-10 and Richmond and Georgetown. And so you don't want to impose what has happened to the Hoyas on top of Richmond unduly. But again, until they've proven that it's not going to be an issue a second time or a third time, you know, I'm going to have that hesitancy built in.
I think they benefit from what they did last season, going to ACC country, you know, going to Doran Stadium and winning on the grass, and then taking Cornell right to the edge. Again, the toughest game that Cornell played last year was against Richmond in the quarterfinals. Can you imagine if the Spiders roll into Charlottesville and championship weekend,
oh my God,
and the support that they could get just an hour and a half from their campus, maybe 2 hours from their campus? I'm not sure
outrageous.
What it is.
No, it's less than that. I'm looking at hotels in Richmond.
It could turn the tables in their favor and become really special.
Well, it's a perfect segue into, I think Virginia deserves to be talked about next in this conversation for a couple of reasons, and you pointed to two of them already. The first being, I do think that there are similarities in the conversation to Maryland, right? Maybe not so much in the sense that we had, you know, national championship level expectations for them heading into the year, but certainly insofar as the season got off to a start that was cause for concern. If one of the like general topics that the lacrosse community has discussed over the course of the first 2 months of the year was whether or not Richmond Notre Dame was going to be streamed, one of the other ones is about, you know, Lars Tiffany's contract status and what that means for the program going forward. But I just think that when you take the Utah, Dartmouth, and Notre Dame results in conjunction with one another, what it shows is a level of internal improvement as the season has gone on that is a function of tinkering with personnel as well as buttoning things up schematically. My preseason point of view on Virginia was that they were automatically going to be better than they were in 25 because of their offensive personnel. To me, while there were issues all over the field, the thing that made it very difficult for them to win games in 25 was that they were consistently relying on four guys offensively, and 5 through 9 just weren't at the normal Virginia standard. That was not going to be the case this season, and I do think that is a building block for why they've been, you know, effectively good but not able to completely win games in February. And what's changed is how buttoned up they are off ball. And that was never better exemplified than against Notre Dame. And we're both goalies. You were a much, much, much higher level goalie than I was. One of the eternal conversations in lacrosse is the codependency between making saves and the looks that you want your defense to give up. What have you seen when you have watched Virginia improve over the course of the last couple weeks?
I mean, specifically when it comes to Jake Merrick, his ability as a righty on his right pipe to make that offside high save against Notre Dame. He made 2 or 3 gems that way. I thought he was better at his feet in the Dartmouth game, but he showed me something. You know, his balance isn't ideal, and he's a little all over the place at times, and he's not the biggest cat. But if he can play the way he did against Notre Dame, that team's going to be difficult. I'm just impressed that they've maintained their aggressive style, you know, in the face of maybe being over aggressive in that loss to Johns Hopkins, that brutal loss that if you played that game 100 times, I'm not sure Hopkins wins any more than 3 or 4. But they bounced back and they stayed true to their identity. They stayed true to playing fast. They stayed true to hunting goals in early offense and in transition. But to me, it's a development of Brendan Millen. Not only is he the best freshman in the country, right now he's got to be considered as a first-team All-American the way he's played in this last month. I mean, he's just putting up monster numbers. He's making great decisions. He's shooting the ball effectively. I couldn't be more impressed. He looks more like a senior than a freshman.
We can talk about your favorite topic, that being midseason All-Americans, once we get through some of this team-by-team discussion. I finished my ballot right before we pressed record.
You know, two things. What do I dislike more, midseason All-Americans or bracketology in March?
Yeah, or artificial fields? Is it just your affinity for grass fields?
Well, I, you know, had a great discussion with Pat Marchant and Gary Gade about grass fields and growing up, and I used to bring clippers to games to clean up the crease because of the undulations. Gary was talking about getting the games early and throwing bounce shots at the goal. And was it a field, you know, with the dirt, you know, make his hop kick up high, or would the sand make the ball skim down low? There was such nuance involved, and every field was a completely different environment. I mean, you had to really, as a goalie, you had to consider that in the way you played, how high your arc was, Terry, you know, where you stood in the goal. Sometimes you stood in, I was so short. Sometimes these things were dug out. The goal was like 7 feet above my head. I was playing in a hole. And so he really had to adjust from a game to game basis, which made it fascinating. And now playing on plastic, these kids can just sit back, heels on the line. You know, that split style, the wide style works better because you don't have to move your feet.
Yeah. Who do you find more interesting, just continuing as we move on and talk about some of these teams on an individual basis, between Duke and Carolina?
I think Carolina is probably a little more interesting. I'm sold that Duke's got quality, but I worry about their attack. You know, I thought in the dome they had a couple guys who kind of were missing in action. We'll find out. This is a huge game, Duke of Virginia this weekend. Carolina, you know their attack's going to show up, and you know they got the Fogo. You know, Carolina, I think their question marks would be more in the goal with a freshman goaltender, Josh Marcus. And then can their freshman middies keep improving? Because if they can, that's a scary unit. I've just been impressed with the way Carolina's played complimentary across this season. Their defense is vastly underrated. Their riding at times been very good, but they just seem to continue to grow. You know, I haven't seen them hit a wall yet. It's just been this slow progression where they keep playing better and better seemingly.
So you hit on what I think is the two most interesting stories for Carolina. And I think you're positioned to kind of talk about both of them, in a unique way. You taught me the lesson that no position is harder to transition from high school to college than offensive midfielders, especially in the ACC, because of the demands that are put on them. Now, that has changed a little bit insofar as, you know, an offensive midfielder now means you're the fourth, fifth, or sixth best offensive player, and you're not expected to play defense aside from in the few instances in which you were at the top in an unbalanced situation, and you just have to get back in the hole and then wait for the teammate to taxi off and you can get off the field. But with that being said, I do think that there's still a lot of truth to it, especially when it comes to production. And the question that I have is the difference between the freshman wall, or not the difference, the balance between the freshman wall, which I think we all should assume that every freshman is going to hit at some point until they don't, versus the built-in improvement for just every practice, right, is like 3% of your total practice time that you've ever had in college lacrosse, you know, as the year goes on. And then equivalently, every game is just a little bit less nervous because you have another game under your belt. How do you balance those two things? And the reason that it's so important is because Carolina has, in my opinion, the most deserve to be run 50-50 first and second midfield lines. And that's taking into account that Caden Harshbarger has you know, been a little bit more injured this year. And that third spot on the first line has been a little bit in flux as well. And it seems like James Madden has kind of grabbed that role, although Luke Mapaluso kind of rotates in alongside Harshbarger and Mason Suchuk, who for me is definitely a midseason All-American to this point. But they've got this all-freshman second midfield line in Luke Bear, who might be the best at setting picks of any freshman I've seen in years. And then Anthony Rayau and, of course, Gary Merrill, who have just they are so scary to guard. If that unit reach, if they don't hit the freshman wall, then I would contend that Carolina's top nine offensively is going to be so much better than anybody else's that when you combine that with their faceoff guy, I don't want to say I don't care about a freshman goalie, but I don't care about a freshman goalie. That's a recipe that, like, I'm not sure how you beat that.
Yeah, you know, I'm covering the Frozen Four hockey next week in Las Vegas. And, you know, typically, like, the team with the best second line, the second shift is given an advantage because the first shifts are going to be great on great, and they're going to neutralize each other. But in Carolina's case, I couldn't be more impressed with the job Joe Bresci and that staff have done with the freshman midfielders. They've put them out there consistently, unlike, let's say, at a place like Johns Hopkins, where their second midfield line has looked like the Cheesecake Factory menu. It changes every single week, and there's a zillion entries, and nine guys are vying for three spots. Carolina just continues to roll those young guys out there. And what is it, Terry, about spring break, where there's a noticeable jump in production from freshmen after spring break? I experienced that personally myself. I don't know what it is, whether it's the accumulated hours, whether it's the lack of academic stress, whether it's the weather changing, whether it's the time and the sunlight now and you're out, but whatever it is, this is the time of year that freshmen usually take a quantum leap. Now, will they hold on and finish May on an uphill, or do they, again, hit the wall? But everything I've seen from Carolina is that these guys have been brought along the right way. They've been brought along slowly. Remember, the midfield position, for as much as you think it's just offense, the schemes from high school to college are massively more confusing and massively more menu in terms of the X's and O's. They've also got to know the riding game. They've got to know the clearing game. They've got to know some early offense and some early defense. So there's so much on their plate initially that I think it's a little overwhelming. And so that's why the midfield position, like the tight end position in football. Remember, a tight end's got to know the pass routes. He's also got to be part of the protection packages and the run game. And so that's similar to the midfielders. They touch everything. And so their practices, they're going to have a lot on their plate during a typical practice. Because if you just say, okay, Gary Merrill, go out and run midfield, and you don't show him the ride, the clear, the early offense, basic defense, pick defense up top, if he doesn't know the rules, then you're going to get exposed somewhere along the line. So it does take time.
The second Carolina topic I want to get your thought on is at the other end of the field. And, you know, whether it was from Michael Evans to Tucker Durkin or Billy Dwan and Jordan Beck, I would contend that Dave Petromala has had a type in terms of the defenseman that he likes. This North Carolina defenseman group is a bunch of guys who are between 5'10 and 5'11 and a half. And that goes against type. And yet, to your point, I agree. They're playing incredibly well. What do you see when you look at the Carolina defense? And how do you explain that this is a Dave Petromala defense when it certainly doesn't, at least getting off the bus, look like what traditionally has been?
Well, because they're moving as one unit. They're moving in gears. Their short stick play is generally been very, very solid, and their long poles are good. But again, lacrosse is no longer a hitting game. And like, so having that 6'4", 240-pound defender, back in the day, like, he would roam the middle, and he'd be a deterrent for people to take, you know, dodges to the middle, and guys would get buried. That doesn't exist anymore. So you got to be mobile. You got to be able to move. And with the picking game, I think if you're a one-dimensional defender, that is, you know, if you're a crease defender or somebody who can't move their feet, you're going to get exposed because teams are going to take you out on the perimeter and get a switch and run by you like you're standing still. And I think that's the strength of the Carolina defense. They don't really have an obvious weak link that you can pick on.
Let's shift to talk about Duke. I asked which you thought was more interesting. And I think that the point you made about questions at the attack for Duke is a very easy place to start, which is, I don't know that they know who their three attackmen are yet. I think that they know Ben Johnston is one of them. I think that they have a hunch that some combination of freshmen is at least one and potentially two of the others. I think that the question is Max Sloat best utilized? Is he a Sam Hanley-esque, while we would love to have him on the field 60 minutes, he is a traditional midfielder, the likes of which there just aren't that many of, and that's why we have to continue to run him out of the box, even though he probably makes the most sense as our left-handed attackman. And all of this is I guess, looked at or evaluated through the lens of one of the stories that I would contend Inside Lacrosse has failed more by not telling than maybe any other, which is in the wake of bringing Kevin Unterstein on as their third assistant and then having him on staff for a year, Duke made a very unique reallocation or redistribution of coach resources. And so Ron Caputo, who had been the defensive coordinator since Matt Donosky, became the offensive coordinator, is now coaching the midfielders. Matt is coaching the attackmen, and KU is coaching the defense. And I think that is a really compelling breakdown of responsibilities. And I think it's an additionally compelling consideration when you've got guys floating between attack and midfield. So while fully concede that between the Denver game and the Syracuse game, the extent to which Duke has been under the lens has rapidly increased over the last 2 weeks and will continue to do so over the next month and potentially 2 months, what do you see when you look at the Blue Devils at the offensive end of the field?
My question would be, can you win a national championship without a behind-the-goal presence? And they really don't have a behind-the-goal presence. This is an offense where the ball's in front of the goal a lot. And historically, that's a trait. You know, typically championship teams have somebody they can get the ball behind the goal to and be a threat. So will Duke show more invert? Will they get the ball behind to Ortlieb and Colsey more as initiators? I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, Ortlieb had 3 goals the other day, but that's the quietest 3 goals I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was a lot of on the crease kind of garbage goals.
Last guy, exactly. Max Sloat was unbelievable. His left-handed sweeps and shots are just downright awesome. I think he's a pro. Ben Johnson's only a junior. He's a pro at the midfield position. His split dodges to his left hand just blew me away. I had the guy listed as 90% right-handed, and he just torches the Syracuse defense down the left alley from distance. And I'm like, where did that come from? You show me that again on tape. But to me, the key guys are going to be Brady Scioletti, Liam Curtius, Michael Ortlieb. Okay, what can you get out of them? Kyle Colsey was a little quiet the other day. He's playing his brother this week. We'll see about that. Tomas Delgado has a lot of potential, and he can be a catalyst to the midfield because you got to short somebody, and if he starts drawing slides, then everything can work. Menke's got to do better. He had a hot start to the season. They're using him on an extra man, but he could be a presence behind the net, the transfer attackman from Virginia. But again, I don't love their offensive depth of scoring. They're very reliant on a few compared to some other teams. Again, when you're blowing out Jacksonville, St. Joe's, and Bellarmine, I think the numbers tend to look better than they are when you're playing quality opponents like Denver and last week up at Syracuse. So it's too much Johnson and Sloat long term, but those guys are unbelievable.
Yeah, Virginia. It, I mean, first of all, so I'm a history major, and this is a game for history majors in the sense that if you're going to pick Virginia, you're going against 2 decades of precedent, and that is a bold place to be. But the other reason that this is going to be a particularly compelling game is because I didn't react to your point that you're impressed by Virginia's ability to stick to their aggressive style. I thought that was something that we saw in the Notre Dame game in terms of what they got out of Joey Terenzi, Hudson Hossman, and Robbie Hopper going forward. And I think what Duke has the capacity to get out of Aide McGuire and Luke Christmas is equivalent. And so this will be an interesting game insofar as if it is close, and I think it probably should be, because in addition to everything we've talked about with both teams, I also think that this is a game where if either team gets good goalie play, it'll be a surprising plus. Jake Merrick has played better in recent weeks, but he's still at, you know, in the 11 save, 9 goals allowed range. He hasn't been in a 15 save, 6 or 7 goals allowed, you know, situation so far. And obviously Duke changed their goalie out against Syracuse.
That's a big question mark. And the Fogo matchup seems like it's fairly even. I mean, although Cal Girard's had a nice year.
Cal Girard is the best face-off guy in all the other non-winning the clamp categories in terms of ground balls, cost turnovers, ability to produce off the face-off. He is the most well-rounded, high-end, from a statistical production standpoint, face-off guy in college lacrosse right now.
Yeah, and Duke's defense is scary because Aide McGuire's out there, and I'm watching in the dome. I'm like, okay, who are you going to pick on? There's only one guy you can pick on. That's the other shorty. And Duke's other shorties are a little young. They got two sophomores and two freshmen, but they're good. They're good athletes. And so you're very limited. And Syracuse did do that. They did pick on that other shorty to get the defense in motion. But it's a very good Duke defense. Henry Bard. So I thought Charlie Johnson really competed his tail off last week in the Dome. I was really impressed. And then Menendez, you know, the sophomore, the big lefty now, he's a talent. So this is a really good Duke defense. I do agree with you, question marks. What do you do in goal now? As Patrick Jameson was not good against Denver, two saves and seven goals against. He comes in. I thought they gave him a quick hook in the Dome, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of that went back to the prior game when he wasn't seeing it. You know, they brought in the transfer from Ohio State, Henry Blake, who did okay. But so I think they have an audition this week during practice, which is never a good thing.
John Vanosky's goalie management dating back to the likes of Dan Wigreiser been fun to watch.
Well, you know, I got a question, you know, and I don't know, but I'm going to do some investigating. They got student assistants, Andrew McAdory. Brendan O'Neill's their director of ops. You got Keith Boyer and Jack Gray on campus at practice every day. And coach is like, yeah, and those guys help out with the goalies. And I'm sitting there as a goalie saying, shoot, I know Andrew McAdory, and he's not going to take it easy on me. Are those guys lighting up the Duke goalies in practice to the point that we're seeing pro-level shots, it's making me better, but also I'm not working, I'm not rehearsing my saves. You know, your warm-up is a rehearsal of your saves. It's not for the shooter to torch corners. And so, you know, sometimes you got to be careful, understand the meaning of a warm-up. It's a skill-building session.
The behind-the-goal presence, in my opinion, is the perfect transition to talk about Notre Dame, because for me, they have three options. And the question is, which do they want to pick one and run with it? Or is it going to be this uncertainty question that we have for the Irish? Because I think ideally for this season, it would be Josh Yago. And I think that, you know, at 3.4 points per game, you might say we want to get a little bit more out of that position. But I think he brings a lot in the other elements from creating turnovers and picking up.
I don't see him as an ex-attackman, though, Terry. I see him as a winger.
Well, I mean, that's my point. Do you see Teddy Lally or Matt Jeffrey as ex-attackman as well?
Teddy Lally, I think, ultimately will be there. The question is, does that happen this week or does that happen in 2 weeks?
Or does it happen next year? And because
Brock Bierman was playing great, but he was nowhere in that game. Luke Miller had been making shots and being playmaker, and he took some awful shots in that loss at Virginia. So that attack's got to do better.
Well, and that's my point, is that so Luke Miller and Brock Bierman, I think in the context of the offensive midfielders and Yago and Lally and Jeffrey are I don't like saying this because these guys are so much more athletic than I am, but they're the non-athletic skill players that can be less athletic than their complementary pieces because those other four guys on the field are so athletic. Correct.
Yes.
But the point is, do you want to have both those guys on the field? Do you want to have only one of those guys on the field? Depending on who it is, how do you maintain your righty-lefty balance? And ultimately, if the guys like Will Angrick and Wilma Harris and Jalen Seymour are the ones creating offense, what does that mean for what your expectations are, production and facilitation-wise, for whoever it is between Yago, Lally, and Jeffrey? And I think that that's this like stew that was always going to be the story of Notre Dame's season, because you don't have that is the hidden thing about having Kavanaugh-Taylor and then Kavanaugh-Taylor last year, which is we've got two pieces that we know what they are and we're not going to deviate from them. And last year, like how they deployed Matt Jeffrey and then, you know, incorporated their Brady McCorney, like those were the questions. And it was like the inability to answer them, I feel like, was what undid them. And now it's not four roles that you have to figure out. It's six. And I think I'm not saying it's the curse of having too much talent, but when you have non-differentiated talent, I think that, you know, it's hard to have 13 guys to make nine, but that's what it feels like Notre Dame's situation is.
When I watch games and I chart games, I'm really interested in how teams score. and how much passing is involved. Like if you watch Duke's offense against Syracuse last week, it's like dodge and score, dodge one pass and shot. There was very little dodge, pass, pass, re-dodge, pass, 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 go. You know, and I think quality teams are able to multiple pass into strong angle shots. And I think the big deal, like Notre Dame's personnel says, we want to attack you from the top down. As you said, Matt Jeffrey, Jalen Seymour, top down. Well, the problem with top down is typically your angle gets worse the further into that play. You go top down, it's not there. You pass down to a wing for a shot, you know. So ball reversal is critical. I think if we started doing analytics for lacrosse, I would love to see you and your guys there. Like how many times we get the ball back to front or east to west in a possession and what that translates into offensive efficiency. Because I am a huge believer in ball reversal. And again, you heard Matt Ward talk about it when Virginia was playing Dartmouth last week. Get the ball behind the Millen and then good things happen. Because his feeds from behind to front generally lead to better angled shots. You're turning the defense's head. You're turning the goalie's head. And so a lot of those factors, you know, I think are critical, especially when you're talking about attacking elite goalies, whether it be in the PLL or a guy like Caleb Fiak at Ohio State, who's so big, or Jimmy McCool, who's so big. When you attack top down on them, you're settling for some low angle shots from the wing. I think it's much more important to get the ball behind. And how many teams can do that? I'm not sure Duke can do that, and I'm not sure Notre Dame can do that.
Syracuse can. So I'll just Syracuse is 8-2. At one point last week, they had the number one RPI and number one strength of schedule. Should Syracuse fans be satisfied by what they've seen so far from the Orange?
Well, first of all, their fans are the best in the game. That place was unbelievable the other day. What, 9,000? They got 7,000 for Georgetown, 10,000 for Maryland. They got 5,000 for a game earlier. I think it was BU. So they've got the four top attendance figures this year. One school. It's got all the top four attendance figures. So, and to me, it's, you got Joey Spallina, you got a team who's winning games. They're playing an attractive style. It's a good watch. And the fans come out. And those fans know their stuff, man. Those fans are all over every play, whether it's a man down stop, a ground ball that goes back out of the sideline, a run out. Man, they are so smart. I could close my eyes and not watch the game and watch their fans and tell you exactly what's going on. That's how good they are. But no,
but should they be satisfied?
Legit. What I've been impressed with Syracuse is Gary Gates' development of their midfield personnel. And it's changed at times, and I think it'll continue to change. But like a Matt McEntee now is much better than he was in February. They found a spot for Bear Anderson. You know, originally he was that third starter at attack. Well, now they're isolating him up top against a shorty. He's going to start drawing poles, I'll tell you that much. But I just like the continued development. While Wyatt Hoddle may have been the star in February, I remember when he was isolating from the invert, he's now more of a complimentary part. They've used Tyler McCarthy as a defensive midfielder. So there's been a lot of change, subtle changing and growth that goes on. And that's really a key part of April is coaches will tend to want to shrink their roster. They'll try to want to shrink from playing 22 to 24 down to 18. And coaches who do that will not be hoisting a gold trophy on Memorial Day. This is the time of year you've got to find ways to play more people. You've got to play that third and fourth shorty more. It's getting hot. You've got to play the second midfield more. Develop that freshman on the third midfield so he can do something for you. So I look for teams this time of year who can play more people, not less.
Charlie Craftson might be the most out of
Charlie
position
Craftson. He was a little quiet
looking
the other
player.
Day against Duke, but the prior game he was outstanding against Georgetown.
Can you recall a defender who produced offense like Billy Dwan? Like he is not somebody who runs down the field with the ball on his stick, closes his eyes and shoots. The fact that he is actually a crease attackman with a long stick is insane. And he's so good consistently. It's not just when he catches and finishes. He does other things. He opens up other teammates through his gravity and his pick play. It's unbelievable how good this guy is at the position that is not nearly his position. Maybe it's because he's so good at guarding these guys as well. It's unbelievable.
He is one of my favorite players. And, you know, the way he runs the field, whether it's with the ball on a stick or as the trailer in the trailer break, and then he understands at times as the trailer or the first guy down, I got to cut the crease because I got to suck that defender down to open up the trailer. And that's a huge play. And when he scored that goal the other day on the backside crease, I had no idea who it was. And all of a sudden Cam's like, Dwan on the backside. I'm like, how the heck did he get there? You know, and he's making good decisions. He's not like, it's not like he's playing foolish, reckless lacrosse like some other LSMs, because there's a bunch of LSMs right now. I don't know what's going on.
We've talked about a few of them on this podcast already.
These guys want no part of playing defense, and all they want to do is run and shoot. But Billy Dwan III is making the right lacrosse play time after time. He's super smart. His dad liked to push it in transition, and his dad was known for scoring goals. But
well,
he didn't
and his
have
uncle for sure.
He didn't have 20. And this guy's, you know, he's encroaching on Joel White in terms of scoring. So it's fun to watch because a lot of it, the trailer break is a really cool play and a lot of teams now settle. But that 5-on-4 can lead to good opportunities both right away or then you create matchups. So you keep doing what you're doing, Billy Dwan, because it's great TV. And then the finishing, I mean, his shooting percentage is off the charts. If you should use him on Man Up.
We're going to get accused of ACC bias for this podcast. I'll just remind folks that we spent about 10 or 15 minutes talking about Richmond. I don't think you're going to get a better conversation about the Spiders
outside
of... We talked
about Princeton, didn't we?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, and that's kind of where I was going next. Like, between the Ivy League and the Big Ten, some very interesting conference races emerging. I think the Tigers are interesting insofar as... the question marks around who's their third attackman between Pipinano and Chad Palumbo was one of the more interesting, like who was going to replace Colter McAsee questions heading into the season. I had questions around Nate Kabiri as a behind the goal presence relative to as a really accurate ready shooter. Tucker Wade has, in my opinion, taken a step forward as far as his midfield production, separated himself a little bit from even the likes of John Dunphy. And then
Dunphy's
ultimately
playing great.
He is for sure, but I think Tucker Wade is playing better than at any point in his career.
I watched Tucker Wade, and I'm saying, how come this guy doesn't have 4 goals a game? Because every time he goes to the goal, something great happens. Princeton is loaded on offense. I mean, loaded. They got Bonanno out of the lineup for the last 3 games. It's no big deal. They rotate Palumbo down. You know, Dunphy's running by his guy every time. His separation quickness is elite. Tucker Wade is unbelievable. Palumbo wins the body battles. Like they got different body types and skill sets to make it really fun. Colin Burns on the inside, and obviously you mentioned Kabiri. The second midfield's fine. I don't see an obvious weakness to Princeton. I really see them. Just something I gotta really study their defense a little more. I love their first 2 shorties, Jackson Green and Miller. After that, there's a noticeable drop off. Without a doubt, there is a noticeable drop off. If you watch that Lehigh game last night with notes, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a noticeable drop off. But that team, Princeton, can run. They run really well off Kroddick saves too. So they're not just a half field team. There's a lot to like there, and I think they're going to be in a couple heater type games like they were last year in their quarterfinal game against Syracuse. I think they're going to be awesome to watch in the tournament because they're going to score. They're probably going to give up a lot of shots, and it's going to be a high tempo game.
Jack Stahl, probably the Schmeiser Award winner at this point, right? If we're considering what we've done so far. I mean, nobody at least garnered as much attention for quality performances as he did in terms of locking down.
Sean
opponent,
likes the best defender in
once.
The country.
But
he has those pelts. But again, Princeton plays zone every now and then, and you know, he didn't make a play last night. I'll just tell put it that
yeah,
way.
But Lehigh doesn't.
I had to look on the roster to see what number he was wearing. That's not a good sign when I can't find the best defender in the country watching a game.
That's not necessarily
true. Organically, I could not find him.
What did Luke
you
Breslin
make
do?
Plays.
No, you don't. Not if your job is to erase the opponent number one. Like, that's the whole thing, right? That's the whole conversation about how you value defensemen. Do you want...
Yeah, but if he's going to win the Schmeiser Award, I should be able to say, oh, there's Jack Stahl. Look at him. He's got a great stance. He's out covering this guy. I thought he was number 7 or number 17. I couldn't tell initially. I had to look him up as number 28. That's not a good sign. He's an elite player. And your job is to be quiet and not to be noticed. But you notice great... Like, when you watched the New York Giants in the 80s, did you notice Lawrence Taylor?
It's a different sport. Like, okay, and The reason
when you watch Ohio State play
is because
do you notice their safe? Do you notice their safety play? Like,
again, it's a different sport. The reason I love this conversation so much is because, and I thought Princeton last year was one of the best examples of it. Colin Mulshein or Michael Bath, they were very different players with very different responsibilities and very different production profiles. Which
Comp. Throw a defensive comp. Riley Figueres. I'd say Riley Figueres can cover every bit as good as Jack Stahl.
Sean Light had 7 caused turnovers last season.
Sean Light can cover better than any player in the country. People can't.
That's
get
fine.
Him.
My point is that like he doesn't make plays the way that you're describing.
No, but you notice him. You're like, who the hell is that guy? And
so we're talking about like athletic profile bias. You notice him because he's really tall.
I'm just telling you.
You
watch the game, and my eyes go to him. I'm like, wow, they want no part of that guy. That guy sticks out. Who is that?
We're not going to solve the problem. Like, I literally asked, I think all four or five Princeton coaches last year. No. What I'm saying is that I asked, each Princeton coach last year, who was more valuable to your team, Colin Mulshein or Michael Bath? And they didn't have an answer. So the point is that there almost is no answer. And for me, that's what makes it the best conversation right now in lacrosse, especially in a post-shot clock era, when my contention is the number one skill that is more useful than it was pre-shot clock is a defender's ability to pick up a ground ball in traffic and not immediately turn the ball over. Because that play, when it happens, is the most destructive play in the sport, right? Because it resets the shot clock. You don't have an opportunity to sub and get fresh bodies on. The offense usually does because they probably already have their D-middies on. So now you're getting a fresh midfield unit on. And it the whole thing is just so destructive. And so when you overlay that with the usefulness of picking up ground balls and causing turnovers relative to just making sure that the opponent's best player doesn't score as much as he usually does, it's a little bit of this Scylla and Charybdis, you know, immovable object versus unstoppable force type thing. And that's why I enjoyed the conversation so much.
It's a difficult position to, you know, stats don't tell the story. Stats
Correct.
Don't tell the story.
Yeah.
Because my guy will score. You know why? Because I had to slide off of him. I had to help my other teammate. My guy scores. That happens all the time. People are like, yeah, right. He had 3-2 against you. He had nothing. He had nothing. In the scheme of our defense, Jack Stahl had to slide upfield and his guy scored. Like, it's very difficult. And that's why, again, watching games is so critical for that position. Princeton, Harvard looming down the road. Princeton lost to Cornell. Let's not forget that. It's Cornell in the head of Princeton while we're on Princeton. But then Harvard, I do want to say Jack Spiedel, I thought was really good against BU. He's a good player, man.
So I love Harvard. I think that there's a lot. I mean, I was the guy that had them as the number one team after they beat Syracuse for a month. And the reason was because they had the best win of the year at that point, and they didn't lose. So I only drop teams when they lose. Now they have lost. But they're 2-0 in the league. Everybody else, there are 3 teams that are 2-1 between Cornell, Penn, and Princeton. Yale is 1-2. Brown and Dartmouth are both 0-2. Yale's win over Cornell opened up the league in a way that Yale's loss to Penn could have potentially closed it. And had Dartmouth finished off their upset versus Penn, I think they were up 12-6, and Penn scored the last, I think, 7 or 8, 9, 10 maybe goals of the game. That would have opened it up even more. So this is a league where both the top spot, right, is a little bit open. I don't think it's just Harvard-Princeton. I think Harvard-Cornell is going to be interesting as well. I think Harvard-Yale is going to be interesting as well, based on the history of that rivalry. And so, you know, do Brown or Dartmouth have what it takes in order to get into the conversation for that fourth spot? Based on what we've seen so far, I would say no. But, you know, we'll see.
That doesn't mean they're not going to jump up and beat somebody, because Dartmouth correct. Could do that. The league, Terry, you got the league in your bracketology is getting 3 teams into the NCAA tournament, an automatic qualifier, and then 2 others.
Yeah. Now that it's April, we're allowed to talk bracketology. Is that what you're telling
me? Well, I mean, I'm covering the Ivy League tournament, so I'm really kind of dialing in right now more on the Ivy League squads. Luckily that I got to see Princeton last night. I got to see Harvard last week. And just kind of figuring out what's what. Again, Harvard's offense, great passing. They generate quality looks. They got multiple guys who can score. really loved what I saw for them, but their defense is vulnerable when they don't win faceoffs. And Graham Stevens is a really, really good goalie. I think he's been under a lot of pressure, but I like that kid a lot.
Yeah. I got a text from, I don't think he would bother or care about me saying this. Peter Lasagna 2 weeks ago saying the reason he was buying stock on an April and May basis in Carolina and Harvard was because each team's midfield, referring to the freshman midfield line for Carolina and the first midfield line for Harvard, were the most dangerous, the ones that you were most concerned with. How are we going to guard these guys? You talked about attacking Duke's second shorty.
So yeah,
we call that six-man offense, meaning like your number six most dangerous player is going to be disproportionately responsible for how good your offense works. Harvard is so well situated to play number six offense because, you know, if you pull Logan Ipp and, you know, John Oren is being guarded by Aiden McGuire, they've got a load of options with experience and familiarity to attack that number too shorty with. And I think that's a really useful place to be. For me, their storyline goes as Nate Cobury's in-season improvement goes.
Yeah. And you got a whole, when you're playing quality opponents and you're only winning 35% of your faceoffs.
Yep. Let's quickly touch on the Big Ten standings. You hit it at off the top, right? I mean, the first conversation we had on this podcast was about Maryland. You know, they're 1-1 in the league coming off of a win over Michigan. This game against Ohio State coming up on Saturday is super compelling for a million reasons. Another showcase spotlight game. It's a 6 p.m. Saturday night game, so a lot of eyes are going to be on it. You have covered a lot of Big Ten teams so far this year. You mentioned Penn State. Hunter Aquino's absence remains one of the compelling injury issues. Caleb Fiok's injury status is another. What do you see when you look at the league in total?
I see defensive-based lacrosse other than Penn State, whose offense seems to have perked up without Aquino the last couple of weeks. What they did against Ohio State was sensational. The ball movement was just beautiful. Diversification and scoring. They're the team right now, to me, who's the hottest team in the league. Maryland's added Riley Reese defensively for Will Schaller, and it's actually helped them off ball a bit. But their issue is going to be, do they have a prime number one cover guy when they play some of the killers? Johns Hopkins lost last week at Rutgers was hard to believe. You play that game 100 times and you probably win 99 times. And Rutgers and Ohio State are defensive based teams. You know, I give Rutgers a lot of credit in that game because they were not playing great lacrosse and yet somehow they stayed with it. And put enough pressure on Hopkins. They didn't give up. And so then Hopkins made some mistakes. And that comes from Rutgers not giving up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the way I framed that game was it was because of the way that their Ohio State game unfolded, where, you know, for Rutgers at this point, like, we got to find Big Ten wins in order to get into the Big Ten tournament and then figure out where we go from there. I mean, obviously, all six teams make it, but you get my point with respect to being a 3 or 4 seed. And the Ohio State game was disappointing, right? They got out to an early lead. They were facing a backup goalie in Jack Allen, who, you know, there was no familiarity with, and he made 10 saves and let in 2 goals. And it's hard not to say that was the factor in the outcome of the game. The way the fourth quarter unfolded before they scored with less than 1 second to go in regulation to tie it and send it to overtime, I counted what I think you could fairly describe as 13 missed opportunities, including a 2-minute penalty where they got saved twice, but got both rebounds and hit 2 pipes. And that was after 3 different good Carden Stoller saves that did not yield settled offensive possessions. So right there between the 12-minute mark and the 7-minute mark, there were 7 missed opportunities, and then there were more. So for them to get that win is very heartening. And I think to your point about how damaging the loss could be for Hopkins psychologically, to me, it has a lot of similarities to Virginia's loss to Hopkins. Certainly not as dramatic of a fall from ahead win, but we saw Virginia, we have seen Virginia rebound from that, right? And now it's incumbent on Hopkins to do the same thing. And they've got an opportunity, the best opportunity in the league with Penn State coming to town this Saturday.
Yeah, and what we looked at as kind of maybe a five-team race in the Big Ten this weekend, I think goes a long way to maybe redefining the top-tier teams. You know, Maryland, Ohio State, Penn State, Johns Hopkins. Ohio State, are they going to get a win here? Are they going to drop Hopkins? Are they going to turn the ship around? Are they going to drop? And, you know, kind of maybe tiers and layers being determined in the conference for now?
I think tiers or layers are kind of the way that you have to frame all these, right? With the exception of the ACC, and so far as it's just, you know, the tier that matters is who's fifth. And we thought it was Virginia, and so far it's not. So that's an interesting race. But, you know, the tiers in the Ivy League are you know, important to identify as well. And same with the Big Ten. Let's bring this podcast in for a landing. I'm not going to ask you to talk midseason All-Americans, except to say this. The most hidden position on the field is short stick defensive midfield. I apologize for putting you on the spot and not preparing you. Any shorties stand out that you've seen so far this season? Because well, that's the lone spot.
Aiden McGuire, clearly. Aiden McGuire, you know, the way he plays defense, it's like having a pro out there. You know, he loves the crowbar. He can run from D to O. I was just amazed at how many shifts he took last week for Duke in the dome in that you know, high possession game. But he's a huge chip because, again, you don't want to go after Poles. You don't want to go after McGuire. What's left? There's like one guy you can take to the rack if you're going to play offense that way against Duke. I honestly thought Princeton shorties were pretty good last night. The first two, Jackson Green and then Cooper Miller. I thought they looked like they could handle matchups, and I love the way they get up the field. I was extremely impressed with that group. Notre Dame's top two I like a lot. I think there's a drop-off after that.
Is that Alakwa, Reinhardt and
Reinhardt and Alakwa are pretty good? Yeah.
What about Reese DeSico?
I think
he puts up big numbers. Does he take too many risks? Give up too many goals?
I mean, yeah, people run by him. He's not fast in space, but he's a scrapper.
It goes back to that conversation about production versus your ability to guard your man. And I understand that it's different depending on your position on the field, your role in the team and everything else. But there's no question. I mean, he is the most productive short stick D-mitty in college across. Puts up better numbers from a cost turnover and ground ball standpoint than even Aiden McGuire does on a per game basis. So warrants consideration.
People are running from 23 to avoid him. People are targeting 18 to take him to the rack. Like there's a big difference in that, you know, there's respect for, we're not even going there this week. Again, the best corners in the NFL don't lead the league in interceptions.
Let's end this by talking about Scott Stadium. How do you feel about Scott Stadium? What is it? Yeah. Delta Star, whatever the brand.
I played in Scott Stadium twice. I have one story. Yeah. We won there once. We lost there once. I played not a great game there when we lost when I was a senior, but, I think when I was a sophomore, we played there a junior, and I'm walking off the field at halftime, Terry, and we're losing by two or three goals. And our 81-year-old ball boy, who never said anything to me, Georgie, where I'm the last guy, cause the locker rooms are the other end of the stadium. So I'm walking off the turf and he waits there for me, this guy. And he goes, "Hey, Quint, get your goddamn head out of your ass and start making some saves." And I was like, "Oh my God, where did that come from?" I'm like, "I guess I'm not really playing very well right now." And I went in the locker room and got it together. We ended up winning that game. And that was the only time in 4 years that this, he was a former engineer. He actually built the Bay Bridge, but Georgie retired it. And he used to come out to practices and smoke his pipe and cigars, sit behind the net and be our ball boy at 81. But that was the only time that he got in my face. So I will never forget that.
Incredible note to end on. Quint, as always, appreciate your time.
Again, in Charlottesville, I love the fact that the college game's coming back to a campus. And I think Charlottesville's got a lot to offer.
It'll be fun. That'll do it for this edition. It was great to catch up, buddy.
Way to go. Don't quit.
Don't quit.
We need a new open for it because now we have 75 Division I men's lacrosse teams.
You're right. Do you have any ideas for what you would want to say? Do we have a catchphrase?
Ah. Do we